What's up? Today we got Brett Vanant from the School Sucks Project. We talk about education, we talk about the American school systems, critical thinking, how to progress as a person, how, you know, even got in a little bit about parenting and what they can do to help their kids progress and stuff like that. So just a lot of really interesting topics and interesting conversations. So hopefully you guys really enjoy this conversation. I know I did. And just like a lot of these shows, I just can always take something from it. I always learn a lot from these shows.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today, this is a supplemental installment of the show. Last week, I appeared on a program called the Ripple Effect Podcast. I want to thank the host, Ricky, for having me on. The show features a really eclectic mix of guests. I was actually pretty impressed with his list of previous guests, John Rappaport, the amazing Jonathan, one of my favorite magicians slash comedians growing up, James Corbett, James Evan Pilato, Dan Carlin, Lee Camp. So it's definitely worth checking out. Just search Google for the Ripple Effect Podcast. You can find them on Podomatic and you can find their Facebook page. This is a couple of highlight clips from a 2+ hour show. If you want to listen to the whole show, it's up on his page. I will tell you, it has no editing in it and not my style, as you know, but it gives you a sense of the flow of our conversation for sure if you listen to it unedited. So lots of stimulating work being done over at the Ripple Effect. And thanks one more time to Ricky for having me on. The first clip begins with us discussing Charlotte Thompson Iserby in the deliberate dumbing down of America. And the second clip begins with us discussing college. I will tell you, I pulled this audio from his end. My Skype connection is a little chunky at times, but it's definitely listenable. So I hope you enjoy this. More stuff coming soon, like a couple hours from now. So stay tuned. I hope everyone's enjoying the season. Have a great day.
So what do you think is the biggest issue? Or you talked a little bit about, you know, just, I guess, the conspiracy behind the educational system. You have people like, was it Isabel? She worked for the Department of, I think I wrote down her name.
Isabel. Oh, under Ronald Reagan? Charlotte Thompson Iserby.
Yeah, Iserby. That's who it was. Yeah, and she worked for the Department of Education under Reagan. And, you know, people like her, they talk about how it's a deliberate. And do you believe that? Do you believe it is? I mean, I know there's quotes by John Rockefeller about, you know, he doesn't want a nation of thinkers. He wants a nation of workers and stuff like that. Do you think it is deliberate?
Well, all right. So I think an important place to start when really trying to investigate the story or the agenda behind public education is who are the people reporting about it? And a lot of these are people that I find very credible. Charlotte Thompson Iserby, who, you know, her revelations about what was going on in the public school system go at least back to the 1970s when she's from Maine and she ran for school board, and she basically started to realize all these things that were kind of alarming. And that might have been what inspired her to run for school board, because I think she had two young children. But she said that she found schools were doing away with what she considered to be traditional education, grammar, math, history. So this is all prior to working her way into the Reagan administration. And she would speak up about this at school board meetings. And eventually, I think, like, another teacher came to her and said, oh, yeah, you're right. You're on to something. Like a former teacher, and said, you have to go and attend these, I think they were called, like, change agents seminars, where you want to be a change agent. So she goes to this course in Maine where they're passing out some textbook, The Innovations in Education, A Change Agent's Guide. And this was to what she thought was it was going to revolutionize the schools to do exactly what she's talking about, this deliberate dumbing down. But what is Charlotte Iserby's viewpoint? You know, where is she coming from? Well, if you listen to her talk, it's very clear that she has a strong foundation of Christian values, which is fine. I'm not, you know, judging that. It's just it's an important piece of information in determining where she's coming from and how she's seeing a progressive left-wing agenda in education. She is clearly pretty conservative. And there's a lot of other people who are similar to her. You know, people like John Taylor Gatto, Samuel Blumenfeld, and they're all reporting on this deliberate dumbing down. Do the people who are pushing this agenda, maybe on the other side of the political spectrum, the liberal or progressive side, see it as a deliberate dumbing down? Most of them probably don't. Most of them probably would view it as an evolution in education. And the reason why people like Iserby see it as a dumbing down is because it's moving away from what she has determined to be important traditional values. Now, what are the results? The school curriculum is certainly not as rigorous and challenging as it was, say, 40 years ago, maybe when my parents were in high school, or 100 years ago. And this is something that's been brought to my attention numerous times by listeners or even in interviews. People find these competency tests from like the beginning of the 20th century. And it's nothing that for like sixth and seventh graders, it's nothing that a high school student or a college student could do today. Right. So, yeah, the curriculum is less demanding than it used to be. The people who were perpetuating this system would say it's for a changing world. Right. But it also has some very creepy things in it, like and everything has a euphemism. Right. Everything is presented in a way that would look attractive to parents or anyone who just looks at the surface and says, well, these people are the educators and the Department of Education and the academics. They know what they're doing. I just send my kid there and everything will be OK. Things like school to work. That's a big euphemism. So people will leave school prepared to work. But this is an agenda that goes back to, like, say, the 1920s. And what critics have identified is that it's kind of sorting kids. So it's stealing from them their own direction in life, or their own sense of direction in life, to push them to where they would best be suited for, like, social and economic goals. The people behind the agenda of public school in America, they do think that, you know, they're preparing the next generation to function in a democracy. Right. So that is the important end goal for them. You know what I mean? So is there any evil intent? It's hard to identify, you know, anyone, you know, giggling in a dark room about, you know, what they've done to America's children. Evil can usually catch a ride on the back of people's good intentions. And it can usually catch a ride on the back of obedience and conformity. There's not a lot of people. I mean, I like I told you earlier, when I was in graduate school, I was 24 and I hated school for at least 8 or 9 of the 12 years that I spent there. And it never even occurred to me that there would be a discipline of criticizing or questioning the public school system, right? So most people will never do that. I can't say for sure that there was an agenda to make people dumber, but there definitely was, you know, this school to work system, which was done in Germany all the way back into the early 1800s. And their school system, the Prussian school system, is what the American school system is based on. It was done by the Soviets, right? In a very, very planned economy. It was done by the Cubans. So it doesn't have the best history. And it's being done in America because there was a lot of sympathy for the planned economics of the Soviet Union by the progressives. And the progressives, they also liked the Nazis. They liked the fascists. They liked that regimentation of society, that everything was ordered and that everything was planned. They didn't know. I mean, the progressives didn't like Nazi Germany, like, after the Holocaust, you know, but they certainly liked it in the 1930s. They said, wow, these people really got their acts together. Germany was falling apart in the 1920s. And look at them now. They're you know, an economic and industrial powerhouse. And they've got this super regimented and loyal society. And we need to build that here through the same kinds of regimentation. So when you look at it from the viewpoint of Charlotte Iserby, let's say, let's just use her as an example, positionalist, a conservative, a Christian, and she sees these drastic changes being planned. When she did wind up working, she was essentially an education policy advisor for the Reagan administration. She said, I sat in an office with all the records, you know, going back almost 100 years of this agenda. So there is a deliberate attempt to change society, whether it's for the benefit of democracy, as a lot of the progressives would say, or if it's for an increased economic or industrial efficiency, as a lot of people funding the progressive experimentation in education maybe wouldn't admit. But the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, they put tons of money into this progressive experimentalism in education. So depending on who you ask, you know, if you had them hooked up to a polygraph machine, I don't know what they would tell you, but I think most of the people on the academic end would think what they were doing was going to benefit society, a changing society, an evolving society in the long run. But they were very socialist, you know, they were very collectivist, and that's a big problem.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because I think a lot of times we just always assume that it must be these evil people and they're all evil. But I think a lot of times greedy people just find a way of taking advantage of people who have maybe the right intentions. You know, it's just like, you know, I say we use the terms like tree hugger and you know, this and that. And it's just like a lot of these words, it's like, OK, so this person's he cares about the environment. It doesn't necessarily mean he's a bad person. It just means his heart might be in the right place. But there's people who will take advantage of that and then maybe just, you know, add more regulation and just make it harder, you know, add more government departments, you know, the EPA will expand or whatever. So it's just like, yeah, you're right. I think there's we have to look at it as, yeah, some people, their heart is in the right place, but obviously they get taken advantage of. And I think it is one of those things where, you know, just thinking about it, because we have a little family owned construction company, and, you know, just having employees, one thing that you realize that it is easier to control people. You almost want, like, the perfect worker is somebody who's smart in the field that you have them that they're working in, but almost dumb in all other aspects. Because it's like, you don't want somebody who's overall intelligent, because somebody who's overall intelligent will ask questions, will wonder why they're doing things, will pick out something that might be unfair and call you out on it. Where you almost want somebody who, you know, doesn't, you know, lacks critical thinking, lacks imagination, lacks these things. And, you know, so I wonder if that has something to do with it, where just like they understand that it is easier to control people when they just don't really look at things outside of the box and they don't question things. And I mean, that might even be the reason why they try to eliminate arts, and nobody really puts a lot of effort into really expanding art programs and music and all this stuff, which I really think is important with just expanding your mind and learning how to look at things from different perspectives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest criticisms of the way school worked in Germany and in the Soviet Union and, you know, consequently in the United States, is that no one is being prepared for jobs that don't exist. And that might sound like, if you just think about this function of school to work, and if you support that function, you'd say, well, of course, that'd be silly to prepare people for jobs that don't exist. But what does that mean? People, like, real education should leave people, like I said before, adaptable and flexible. Right. And willing to take on new challenges and new ideas. It shouldn't be sorting people into these predefined roles for industrial or economic or social efficiency, which are all phrases that the progressive educationists love. Social efficiency seems to be one of the favorites. Well, how do you prepare people for jobs that don't exist? Well, you nurture the raw skills that people have, right? Like critical thinking. It's a process that our mind is naturally wanting to go through. Identifying things in our environment, making sense of them, and then making use out of that sense. None of those skills are made explicit. Critical thinking is basically gone, and you can have people who are very confident in a very specified skill set. But outside of that, like what you're talking about, right? They're a better worker if they're not going to question the big picture. And, you know, I remember being a young professional and looking at the environment that I was working in and saying, look, this really needs to change. I mean, I worked in this boarding school and I was the lead teacher of this specialized campus. Well, it had a clinical component, it had an educational component, and it had a residential component. And I got together with a psychologist who kind of oversaw the clinical component. And I said, look, this is all inconsistent. You know, people are doing different things. We don't have a unified method here. We don't have unified goals. And he was like really enthusiastic about helping me get everything on the same page. Well, all I was met with was resentment. The residential people thought it was going to make their job harder. And the administrators really didn't like it because they said, Brett, you're out of your role. You know, we can find, if you don't like your little job, we'll find somebody else who can do it. And eventually, because I had this psychologist on my side and he had a lot of influence in the school, we were able to make some important changes. But what I found was, after I left, because a friend of mine, or the guy I used to play racquetball with, after I left the school, everything reverted back to what was easiest for everybody within a year. Like all the changes that I had made, all the things I had implemented, they were just gone because I left the school and the psychologist left the school at around the same time. And it just kind of, you know, drooped back to what was easiest. So I remember, like, thinking there would be a reward, right? Because when I was a young professional, after all that schooling that I had been through, I was very interested in pleasing the people above me. you know? And I said, wow, I'm really showing initiative here. And I'm really like determined to make this better. But it really wasn't met with much appreciation. My job was to basically be a teacher on this campus to supervise a few employees and to make sure nobody died and nothing gets set on fire. I mean, that was pretty much my role. So all my efforts to make things better, I remember feeling resented within the institution for that.
Yeah, and I know some teachers, and besides that, most of them that I know seem to be all alcoholics. But It seems like that's a common thing with teachers, that they like to drink. But maybe because they have the whole summers off, and it gives you way too much time to, I guess, recover from hangovers. But it seems like, you know, one thing I hear a lot from coming from teachers is the fact that they really don't have a lot of flexibility either. You know, I mean, I was the first generation that had to pass the MCAS test in Massachusetts to graduate high school. And I remember how much that changed everything, because now teachers were just teaching to a test and they didn't care about like anything else besides us passing this test, because they were basically being judged based on us passing this test. We were being judged based on it, and it kind of fucked up everything, because now a teacher, instead of having, I mean, I don't know how much flexibility they had before, but now they had zero flexibility, because they had to focus on making sure we pass this test, because us passing this test would dictate if they were seen as good teachers, if they did their job, and if, you know, all that. So it just, you know, you basically were memorizing just information, and you're memorizing names and dates and this and that. And there really wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there wasn't a lot of flexibility. Everybody's kind of learning the same thing. And I wonder if that's a, you know, obviously a huge issue, but just the lack of flexibility in, if you were a teacher and you wanted to be creative, do you even have that flexibility?
It depends on where you teach. I mean, there's a lot. This was one of the big criticisms. I mean, I was in graduate school from like 2001 to 2003. And that's where I was surrounded by all these Massachusetts and New York. In New York, they have the Regents. In Massachusetts, they have the MCAS. And for people who don't know, these are basically just tests of what the school are teaching. You know, in New Hampshire, we have something called the NECAP. So this kind of a standardized assessment is all over the country at this point. All these teachers were young, enthusiastic, like most young teachers are, right? They're really passionate, and they really just felt completely handicapped by all of these regulations. They were, one person said, like inspectors were coming into the classroom with clipboards while they were teaching and just writing things down and looking and then walking out. I mean, how would that feel? You know, you feel like an assembly line worker, and you think you're doing this important intellectual creative work. So I remember their frustration and their diminished enthusiasm rubbing off on me before I even got into the public school. Years later, when I was tutoring, I used to work in Boston a lot, in Needham, like the Boston to Needham to Worcester, you know, corridor there. And a lot of money, a lot of really competitive public schools. And I remember going in and meeting with the vice principal of a school and talking about the SAT program that this company that I was working for did. And he's like, basically what he said was, I don't care. Can you give me any guarantees on the MCAS? Because that's the fire under my ass, you know, with like the superintendent, is that we have to do better on this test. Now, how has that played out in the almost 10 years since that experience? Well, there's all these stories coming out about teachers cheating, helping students cheat on these tests. So yes, they're absolutely teaching to the tests. Enthusiasm that young teachers have is destroyed by that process. Students certainly don't love feeling that way either. In some places, you have to write the state standard on the board with the lesson, and students have to log it in their notebooks. So the bean counters and the record keepers can see this if they need to, that these things were taught. So this kind of standardization and systematization has been going on in one form or another for 100 years, right? And it's always the same goals. People like Charlotte Isderby would say it's like a continuation of an 100-year agenda, right? And a big part of it is gradualism, right? Doing things slowly. You know, now it's Common Core. Before Common Core, it was No Child Left Behind. Then Goals 2000, Head Start, outcomes-based education, all the way back to the genesis of the Department of Education in the 1970s, right? And before that, it was something else. I mean, this centralization and centralized control over public schooling, which was traditionally a local thing, goes all the way back to the progressive movement, at least. And you could even trace it back to, like, you know, the middle of the 1800s. when they first brought the Prussian system here and it was copied and spread around the country. There is very little local control today over schools. People tell you these nice things like you can go to a PTA meeting or you can run for school board. But the impact that you're going to have doing anything like that is very small. And now we're even seeing, I recently made a video where there's footage of two parents getting arrested at school board meetings for speaking out primarily against Common Core. Now, that's not happening everywhere in the country all the time, but when parents are getting arrested at school board meetings for voicing objections, it's certainly a bad trend.
Yeah, and I'm a little worried about that because I actually have a kid on the way. I'm having my first kid in general, but I'm having a boy in February, and it's
congratulations.
Thank you. And it's one of those things where, like, one of the things that you obviously think about is like, well, the school system failed me. Like, they kind of just felt like I was a lost cause and threw me to vocational school. Half the day I would go to a vocational school because they felt like, oh, you know, like I said, he's not a book smart kid, so he must be a hands-on kid. And it wasn't that I wasn't a book smart kid. It was just the fact that I wasn't just going to sit in a chair and be told, memorize this. And I don't know what it was. Since I was a kid, I've always been one of those people that I always ask questions. I was raised a Catholic. I would go to Sunday school and ask, well, why do I have to learn this? That doesn't make any sense. Why is this bad and that's not good and whatever, you know? So whatever it was that caused me to do that, I don't know if it was, I think some of it had to do with just being a musician and getting into poetry and art and stuff like that, kind of made me look at things from different perspectives and self-analyze. But I'm worried that, like, my kid might, you know, they might fail him too, you know. And it's like then you start thinking about, well, is there things that I can do at home, you know, and or is homeschooling something that I should think about? And and obviously you hear the common argument about, well, you're going to lose social skills and stuff like that if you do homeschooling. And I know some people argue that that won't happen. I do have a friend that dated a girl that was homeschooled, and she almost seemed like she had anxiety every time she was around a group of people. And not that somebody who goes to public schools can't have the same thing happening, but it definitely seemed like, you know, there probably was a link between that. But from just what would be good advice to a parent who's like, okay, I don't think the schools are doing enough, and I think my kid has more potential. And how do I get his mental juices flowing? Do you think it is something like get him involved in arts, or get him, you know, is there any tactics, maybe get them trying to read at a younger age or anything like that? You think that you've really seen improvements?
I think one of the important things is to break out of the routine. And this doesn't have to be done in any kind of forceful or authoritative way, but learning happens all the time. You know, I think that's one of the principles of real education that's really important for people to understand. So a lot of parents, at least from my experience, what I've seen in my personal life is there's this compartmentalization between school and outside of school. And learning happens in school, which is terribly tragic because for the most part, it doesn't. And most of the things inculcated there are not positive and not terribly helpful beyond some very basic skills. So the idea that learning happens all the time means that any place is a learning environment. And I wish parents would feel, especially with very young children, would feel a greater sense of responsibility to be teachers to their own students before school even starts. Like, maybe there's no way around sending your kid to public school. You know, maybe it's your economic situation, or maybe, you know, you and your wife or you and your husband are separated and they're really opposed to the idea, you know, and you're co-parenting. So it's just becomes easier to send them to public school. Or maybe there's even legal action threat. I mean, these are all stories that I've heard, right? So for whatever reason, your kid needs to be in public school. You can think of a bunch of reasons why that would happen. Or a teacher too, you know, especially if you're passionate about this, you are better equipped and better qualified to be doing education with your child than these people who are basically passing on state standards to students so they can do well on a test in a pretty lifeless and uninspiring way, from most of what I've seen and most of what I've heard. So I think that's the most important thing. Learning happens all the time, or learning can happen all the time. And it certainly doesn't require any force, which is what school is all about. So I think parents shouldn't have such a strong sense of that division of labor. Like, oh, I'm the parent and I just have to kind of be an enforcer for the school, you know, to make sure that Johnny or Sandy does her homework or his homework, but to be a teacher too, you know, especially if you care. I mean, we're only talking to people who care, obviously, about their continuing education and the education of their children. So being involved is a super important thing. Along with that, if the student is in public school, I think parents should be really, really curious about what's going on, and they should be having constructive conversations with their kids about what they see there. you know?
Yeah.
So that would be one of the most important things to do, regardless of who we're talking about. I know I expanded that way beyond just one principle, but learning happens all the time. Learning is not fixed to school. Schooling is really, in many ways, antithetical to learning.
Well, isn't this because their interpretation of intelligence obviously is different than what... I mean, I know I've heard you talk about what's the 9 different types of intelligence, and which a lot of people don't even know about. I mean, how do we go to school to learn how to be intelligent and yet not even know the 9 different types of intelligence?
That's a good question. The other problem with school is it kind of treats everybody like they are all going to fit in the same mold. But every learner is different. And a collectivized system isn't going to pay any attention to that.
You know, we talked about, you know, college, for example. You know, it just, tuition has constantly gone up. I mean, I think I got into for lack of a better term, the real world right out of high school and started working. And, you know, I see a lot of kids who went right to college and, they come out of college. I know a guy who, he was an architect on a job site. And this guy was, designed the project or whatever. And he was probably in his, 50s. And he was telling me that he hasn't even paid off his debt for college yet. I'm like, this guy was in debt from right out of college to the day he passed away. And, I'm like, and what type of life is that? Yeah, you get a great, you might be able to get a better job. But you're also in debt and you're not making money for a lot longer percentage of your lifespan too. So, I have a huge issue with like just how basically all your debt can disappear except your college debt. How it seems like, I've heard a lot about how they say that it's almost too easy to get a loan, that because of it, interest rates are constantly going up and all this stuff. So it just, it's a huge issue. And I'm sure obviously being a libertarian, you probably feel the same way with like, what's your opinions on college? Do you think that it's one of those things that it is a waste of money? Do you think that, but from the other side of the debate where people who say, well, if you have a degree, people will take you more seriously. What do you have to say to people who say that?
Right. So college, it doesn't make sense for most people anymore. Now, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a doctor, yeah, you have no other options. And hopefully in the future that will change. But I really, really encourage people who are being pushed down that path that, you're only successful. Your school experience was only successful if you go to college. That is not true. Now, you're not going to learn anything about your other options in school. School doesn't teach about entrepreneurship at all. Right. But it does exist. And certainly it's not for everybody. Some people might just be more comfortable being an employee and that's fine. But, I went to school for communications, like mass communications and media. While I was in school, my school wasn't very cutting edge. They weren't really keeping up with the times. And while I was studying how things were done in the 70s and the 80s, the entire industry was revolutionized by, digital equipment. While I was in school learning analog equipment. So when I graduated, my degree was basically useless. Now, I say that because if you want to go to college and you're, let's say, 15, 16 years old right now, you have to go to one of the best colleges for it to be worth anything. You have to go to a school that has a huge endowment, right? So if you're studying biochemistry or even journalism and there's some huge innovation, that school is adapting right in the moment to what the new innovation is. The alumni are writing checks and new equipment is coming in and everything is up to date. You don't want to go to some small school with a small endowment that isn't able to, move with the times, right? Because you could wind up without the skills, going into workforce without the skills that you need. So college is only worth something to me today if you can go to one of the best schools, because a college degree isn't worth much more than a high school degree now because of how common it is.
Yeah. And I think that sometimes that's all a college degree is a way of kind of, like a Harvard, if you have a degree from Harvard or whatever. I mean, a lot of times it is just like a bragging thing where it's just like, hey, look, I have this degree. And you might find somebody who's way better for the job who didn't go to Harvard. So it really doesn't tell you that much besides maybe their family was loaded.
Well, yeah. I mean, a college degree used to be a job ticket. Like, here's my ticket. Where's my job? Now it's a job scratch ticket. Like, hey, here's a 1 in 15 chance of getting, getting something. And I would really like to get this message. We've talked about this a lot on the show and I want to be careful that I'm not like anti-college, that I'm not making college sound as bad or as useless as government school. But I just want to encourage young people to think about the choices that they're making. And to be cognizant of the lack of options they're given by their parents, by their teachers, by their guidance counselors, when it comes to this question of should I go to college? It's not this binary choice between a bachelor's degree and McDonald's, especially not in this world, you know, where all kinds of new opportunities are becoming available to the small group of people that can handle them. But unfortunately, most people, through things like Common Core, are being educated to participate in a service economy where they need really no skills, really no critical thinking abilities. And that's terribly sad. But for over 100 years, school has tried to pump out what is needed for economic efficiency, industrial efficiency, social efficiency. People need to recognize that they are a part of that process when they are a part of that process and author their own story and carve their own path the best they can, right? And it's a difficult change to make overnight, but one of the most important purposes of my show is say, these things are going on. Here's some things you can do about it. Here's what I think education really is. And really, just even if all that is too overwhelming, remember that you have ownership over your own life and you can, with, you know, time and effort and some perseverance, set your own path. So school just kind of seems like you can, I mean, I always just felt like I could kind of slip by, you know, like I could kind of just always be under the radar. And I was, but I left there thinking I was not a good learner. I wasn't good at learning. And because of that, I wasn't very smart. And it didn't occur to me till later in life that I had no idea what learning was. I had no idea what education was. And when I learned what it was, you know, I wanted to tell people, and I was really excited. And I really wanted to make that message available for people who were stuck in that environment, thinking that their schooling was their education and the school's judgment of them was consistent with their intellectual ability and their capabilities and their potential, because nothing that's very far from the truth.